fetishization of feelings of inferiority, or a level of self-denial which seems very ill-placed in a life well lived. But I think it can also capture something of great political importance. Iris Murdoch says of it, "Humility is a rare virtue and an unfashionable one, and one which is often hard to discern. Only rarely does one meet someone in whom it positively shines, in whom one apprehends with amazement the absence of the anxious, avaricious tentacles of the self. And although he, the humble man, is not by definition the good man, perhaps he's the kind of man who's most likely to evolve to become good." So today I want to propose an account of humility that attempts to capture this moral significance. And then I'm going to explore the connection between humility, as I've understood it, and ethical development, seeking to understand why it is that Iris Murdoch says that the humble person is likely to become good. If such a connection is vindicated, it will suggest to us that humility is valuable twice over. It has intrinsic worth, but it's also instrumentally valuable in enabling us to become better people. So I'll begin by gesturing at the kind of everyday conception of humility that we have through offering two examples in which the character's lack of humility is particularly salient. I'm going to briefly outline a recent account of humility offered by Nicholas Morite, and I want to suggest that it falls short of identifying the core of the notion. Following that, I'll offer my own account of humility as the trait of not valorising those of superiority. And I want to suggest that this explains the way that humility is manifested and why such a trait would be virtuous. I'll go on to finally argue that humility thus understood is importantly connected with ethical development. So I'll conclude that humility is good, that the humble person is good in a certain respect, and following Murdoch, that they're also likely to become good. So despite Murdoch's contention that humility can often be hard to discern, it seems that it's possible to identify some paradigm cases of it and paradigm cases of lack of it. The two examples that I'm going to use are paradigm cases of lacking humility. And I think in depicting the absence of humility, they illuminate something at the heart of what's missing in these people. So the first is taken from Dickens' David Copperfield, in which Uriah Heep continually asserts that he's a humble man. You should have this when you are found out. "When I was quite a young boy," said Uriah, "I got to know what humbleness did, and I took to it. I ate humble pie with an appetite. I stopped at the humble point of my learning, and says I, hold hard. When you offered to teach me Latin, I knew better. People like to be above you," says father. "Keep yourself down. I am very humble to the present moment," Mark Copperfield, "but I've got a little power." And he said all this, I knew, as I saw his face in the moonlight, that I might understand he was resolved to recompense himself using his power. So Uriah's claims to be humble here contribute to his overall unpleasantness. He claims to be humble in order to ingratiate himself with others, and he's ultimately driven by this great desire to be superior and have power over others. His assertions regarding his own humility are particularly striking because they seem to be self-undermining. They're untrue, and they're undermined by the purpose to which he puts them. So Dickens describes them as exhibiting false humility. Many philosophers regard this kind of striking feature of the case as holding for many or perhaps even all instances of asserting one's own humility. So an account of humility should explain why Uriah Heep isn't humble and should also shed light on the strange self-undermining nature of his claims. A second example comes from George Eliot's Daniel Deronda. So the two protagonists of the novel Daniel and Gwendolyn stand opposed in almost every respect. Gwendolyn has, for all of her life, been surrounded by this kind of servile flattery, and at the beginning of the novel, she's complacent about her own utter superiority. She's particularly proud of her singing talent, until she's told by someone generally recognised as a musical genius that she possesses no particular talent. And on having this realisation, she ceases to be able to enjoy music at all. And the following dialogue happens when Daniel urges her to enjoy other people's singing and suggests that hearing this excellence in others will entice her to pick it up once more. "I should rather think my resolution," which is to stop singing, "would be confirmed," said Gwendolyn. "I do feel able to follow your advice of enjoying my own liveliness." "For my part," said Daniel, "he people who do anything find me always a spirit in each trap. I don't mean they make me believe I can do it as well, but they make the thing, whatever it may be, seem worthy to be done. I can't bear to think my own music, oh sorry, I can bear to think my own music not good for much, but the world would be more disappointed for music itself not good for much. Excellence encourages one about life generally. It shows the spiritual wealth of the world. But then if we can't imitate it, it only makes our own life seem the tamer, said Gwendolyn, in a mood to resent encouragement founded on her own insignificance. So at this point in the novel, she's no longer ignorant about the limits of her talent. But her reaction to this knowledge indicates that she lacks humility. Eliot contrasts this with Daniel's ability to enjoy music, despite his lack of any exceptional talent, which makes her inability to enjoy it seem like a natural continuation of her earlier arrogance. But Gwendolyn's lack of humility is also a barrier to her becoming better. It prevents her from immersing in the world, as Daniel advises her, which means she's unable to escape her kind of self-centred preoccupations. And by the end of the novel, she's a sadly stunted character. I want to suggest that there's a general connection between humility and ethical development that explains this case. So in order to understand what's morally lacking in these two cases, it's necessary to have a more explicit grasp of exactly what humility is. I'm going to first briefly outline Romito's account and argue that it misidentifies the core of humility before setting forward and defending my own account, which may shed light on what's morally lacking in Uriah and why his assertions of his own humility are self-undermining. I'll then go on to suggest that humility is connected with ethical development and explain why it is that Gwendolyn's lack of humility is a barrier to her ethical development. So extant accounts of humility tend to focus on either self-directed or other-directed aspects of humility. Self-directed accounts focus on the humble person's attitudes or beliefs about themselves, and other-directed accounts focus on the humble person's attitudes or behaviour towards others. And since they focus on a single dimension of humility, they tend to struggle to shed light on the range of ways that humility can be manifested. So self-directed accounts tend to fail to explain why the humble person's characteristic is patient and generous with others, and other-directed accounts struggle to explain why the humble person's distinctive attitudes to their self. Romito offers an account that touches on both of these couples. He's recently set forward an account that explicitly aims to capture its moral significance. He says that there's a distinctive subset of the virtues that are virtues of attention, virtues which he says are rooted in patterns of attention. And he suggests that humility is one such virtue. So the humble person, he claims, has a tendency not to attend to their own good qualities and their own achievements, but will attend to the good qualities and achievements of others. Of course, there can be good reasons to attend to your own good qualities, such as like seeing whether you're up to the task of taking on a new responsibility or something like that. So he then modifies his proposal and says that a person's humble if their inattention is the result of a lack of certain bad desires or concerns, such as a desire to overrule their own self-image. So there are three distinct requirements for humility within Romerito's account of humility as a virtue of attention. Firstly, that one have a good quality to be modest about. Secondly, that one direct one's conscious attention in certain ways, away from the trait or its value, or towards the outside causes and conditions that played a role in developing it. And C, that the associated pattern of attention is a manifestation of morally good desires or values. I'm sceptical about all three of these conditions. So first, think of Gwendolyn. She lacks humility, not because of her attitude towards some good quality, but because of her attitude towards her lack of musical talent. And this, I think, calls A into question. Turning to B, that we direct one's conscious intention in certain ways, I think Romerito's emphasis on patterns of attention seems questionable. So a person can seemingly manifest humility in lots of ways, through certain emotions, through certain judgments, actions, for example. So we could need good reason to consider patterns of attention to be uniquely significant. Romerito also claims that patterns of attention he identifies count as humble only because they manifest these good concerns. That's condition C. So it seems that his condition B really identifies a symptom of humility for him rather than its cause. And finally, condition C seems, in a sense, right. It's got to be related in some way to one's desires or values, but it's unsatisfactory without a further specification of which particular desires, cares, or values ground Humboldt Catherine's attention. So it seems like there are morally good cares and concerns that give rise to patterns of attention along the lines that Romito envisages, without saying anything about their levels of humility. So, for example, one might really care about a friend who's really keen on poetry, and as a result, you always attend carefully to skillful poetry readings in order to tell one's friend about them. This might make one a good friend, which is plausibly a good quality, but it seems to say nothing about your level of humility. So I think it's more dependent on specific cares or concerns than he recognises, and he lacks any account of which specific cares or concerns it depends on. So the strength of Romero's account was that it offered a way of unifying the self and other articles of humility. But I've suggested that his focus on patterns of attention misidentifies the core of humility. Romero introduced the idea that the humble person cares about certain things in order to explain why the patterns of attention are morally significant. And the things one cares about do seem relevant to whether one's humble. I'm going to suggest that a particular care or value forms the core of humility. I'm now going to explain and motivate this account and give some reasons to think that humility thus conceived is a virtue. So as I mentioned in response to condition B, humility can be manifested in a variety of ways. And I suggest it's unlikely to be best characterised by any particular manifestation. Rather, it seems to be something to do with the things that the humble person values. My suggestion is that the humble person does not valorise relative superiority. That is, they're not concerned with relative social positions, and they don't intrinsically value being better than others. So the humble person might value their qualities and achievements for their own sake, but not for their impact on hierarchical ranking. This lack of valorisation by the agent of relative positionings can't be the result of kind of mere indifference to the quality or the activity or the achievement in question as a whole, but they've got to concern things they actually care about. So on this account, be humble regarding some particular X, whether that's like a quality or an activity or an achievement, is to care about that thing, but not to valorise relative superiority regarding that thing. But humility doesn't always seem to take this specific form. We don't always think of it as being about or limited to some particular domain. And general humility can be understood on just the same model as involving not valorising relative superiority. So the person who's generally humble simply doesn't value relative superiority. They're not status conscious, they don't value being high up in a hierarchy themselves, and nor do they care about others' hierarchical social positions. So this explains why, for example, Gwendolyn isn't humble as a person. Her care about relative positioning means that music can have no role in her life if she's not highly ranked musically. She refuses to allow herself to value things that don't increase her relative position. So what would it take to be humble? Imagine Anna, a humble runner. She's going to count as humble if she cares about being a good runner, but doesn't intrinsically care about being better than other runners. And she's going to be generally humble if she just doesn't valorise being better than others generally. This account doesn't entail that a concern at being worse than others necessarily indicates a lack of humility. An agent might just take such relative positioning as a kind of indication that they could be doing better than they are, and that they need to be putting more effort into something. So Anna might be disappointed to come last in a race. And if this disappointment were disappointment at the fact that others are better than her, that would suggest she's not humble. But her disappointment could well be because she takes the loss to suggest that she could be doing better, and that's entirely compatible with her being humble. This account has lots of advantages. For a start, we can make sense of the patterns of attention that Romero focuses on. So that was that humble person has little motivation to attend excessively to their own good qualities. This is because doing so isn't going to be a source of comparative pleasure. And neither are they going to be motivated to attend excessively to themselves through an anxious concern that others might be better off than them. It allows that the humble person might sometimes attend to their good qualities, which we wanted in order to allow for those cases in which it seems reasonable. But it just rules out this attention being motivated by comparative concerns. Moreover, the humble person's tendency not to valorise their relative positioning can shed light on the various emotional manifestations of humility. So since the humble person doesn't valorise relative positionings, they're likely to imply their self-aggrandising pleasure at being better than others in particular respects, and all they feel things like envy, jealousy and shame simply at being less good than others. So Anna, for example, isn't going to feel distress if other runners are faster than her or have greater endurance. This means that the humble person is likely to be good at taking pleasure in others' success and feeling sympathy for their setbacks. After all, a significant barrier to such empathy has been removed, which is the selfish concern that their successes and failures might relatively down or upgrade you yourself. So in general, the humble person is unlikely to make anxious comparative judgments between themselves and others, because others' success wouldn't constitute a threat to them. Another characteristic tendency is that the humble person is good at recognising their shortcomings. Well, that's what we would expect, I think, if they're not concerned that such shortcomings would relatively downgrade them. And they're also characteristically good at apologising for those shortcomings. And again, that's what we would expect on the present account. For the humble person, such apologies aren't going to lower them in any important way. Finally, we tend to think that humble people are more likely to be aware of the continued factors that have led to their successes, as well as the ways in which their achievements are dependent on good fortune and the help of others. So, for example, on winning a race, we'd expect Anna to thank those who supported her and acknowledge their contributions to her success. And this too is explicable on the present account. Awareness of one's dependence on other people, as well as the contingent strokes of fortune, seems to destabilise one's position in a hierarchy. As such, the person who valorises relative positioning is likely to find it unpleasant to recognise the role that such factors have played in their success, and therefore to be reluctant to do so. So I think the account makes good sense of the central characteristics of the humble person. It also sheds light on the case I first mentioned, that of Uriah Heep. Uriah spends the entirety of David Copperfield anxiously attempting to improve his comparative position. It matters very much to him that he should be considered and that he should regard himself as relatively more successful than others. As such, he takes great pleasure in the setbacks faced by those around him and is wholly unable to appreciate others. So his general unpleasantness is amplified by asserting his own humility in the service of precisely the kind of one-upmanship that humility guards against. But Uriah Heep's assertions of his own humility are not only strange because of their contrast with his wider behaviour. There was something perhaps generally perplexing about such assertions, an oddness that wouldn't disappear if he did, in fact, generally act humbly. Uriah's assertions serve to call attention to his humility in a manner that suggests an air of competition. He wants his humility to be recognised. He wants himself to be regarded as more humble than others. This suggests that what's often paradoxical about such assertions is that, in at least in part, in making them, one suggests that one's better with regard to humility than others. After all, one's humility is worth calling others' attention to only if one regards oneself as more humble than others. Of course, a truly humble person wouldn't value such relative ranking, and thus would feel no need to self-ascribe humility in this way. This account of humility suggests that it's likely to have good consequences. So humble people are less likely to cause social friction because they're likely to be able to share in others' happiness and enterprise in this case. But I think it allows for more than this to be said. It explains why humility is intrinsically valuable, and as such, it's going to explain why humility is a virtue. So I've said that the humble person doesn't valorise relative superiority. The central reason why this is morally valuable is that valuing relative superiority over others seems to involve a failure to properly value them. In wanting to be superior to others, I seem to fail to fully appreciate them and recognise their worth. Valorising them as superior seems to involve valuing looking down on others and regarding them as lesser in some important way, which seems in tension with adequately valuing them. And since recognition of such worth is of central moral significance, humility is an important moral virtue. Moreover, the trait is going to be virtuous to the extent that the humble person does value the right kinds of thing. They recognise that skills and achievements themselves are what matters, rather than relative rankings. So think of Gwendolyn's inability to enjoy music once she realises that she hasn't got any exceptional talent. It's just that there was a kind of failure in her valuing of music in the first place. Her excessive valorisation of her own relative musical status is at the expense of truly caring about music itself, and that's why she can find nothing to value in it once she realises that she's not relatively excellent. This seems like a general feature of valorising relative rankings. Such cares seem to be wrongly oriented and to indicate a lack of concern for goods and activities themselves. So the humble person then avoids one important way in which our valuing can be distorted. At this point, I want to return to the worries raised in the beginning about humility. I hope we can see that on this account, humility needn't involve inferiority or civility. Not valorising relative superiority leaves open whether you take pleasure or pride in your achievements, and whether you're able to recognise your own good qualities as such. These seem sufficient to ground a sense of self-worth that's in tension with civility and inferiority. Moreover, civility entrenches social hierarchy, but far from serving to entrench and justify social hierarchies, humility is resistant to them. Acceptance of a social hierarchy seems to depend on valorising relative positionings, on viewing those in certain positions as better in virtue of their occupying those positions. Humility thus not only needn't involve inferiority or civility, but it's in tension with some of the assumptions that underpin such attitudes. I hope then that this account avoids those concerning connotations of humility. I've suggested that humility qualifies as a virtue, but I began with the suggestion that it also plays a significant role in development. I'm taking ethical development to be a bit broader than the kind of narrowly moral, although it will have a distinct moral dimension. I'll be arguing that although humility is no guarantee of development, it puts one in a good position to develop. So in the example from down the veranda, Gwendolyn's lack of humility is made apparent in this inability to appreciate music once she realises that she hasn't got any exceptional talent. And eventually, this lack of humility forms a formidable barrier to her becoming a better person. She has some capacity to recognise her own need to change, but she's prevented from doing so by her felt need to maintain her own superiority. She's resolute in preventing others from recognising that they're in any respect better off than her, and she's unwilling to admit this to herself. Since she can't bear to consider herself as lesser than anyone else in any respect, she's also unable to appreciate how to become better. I think this points to some general features of humility, and I want to stress that humility is important for ethical development for epistemic and motivational reasons. So it removes barriers to developing the knowledge necessary for ethical development, knowledge about how to become better. And it also removes barriers to being motivated in ways that aid ethical development. So firstly, humility has some direct epistemic benefits. It removes a significant motivation for distortion in our beliefs about ourselves, allowing us to recognise our successes and failures as such. Since the humble person doesn't valorise relative positioning, they lack a significant motivation to distort what they see in order to reassure themselves that they're relatively more successful than others. And they also lack a significant motivation to regard their own achievements as uniquely admirable or uniquely worthy. They're thus more likely to be able to perceive the true value of their own qualities and achievements. Such recognition seems obviously crucial to improvement, since improvement requires recognising when you've done well or badly. And recognising one's failures seems necessary to know where to improve. The ability to recognise the ways in which your successes are the results of others' persistence or good fortunes, which I mentioned as an ability characteristic of the humble person, is also likely to enable one to have a realistic vision of developing your skills. The kind of flip side of this is that the humble person is also going to be more likely to recognise the valuable achievements and qualities of others as such. They're going to lack a significant motivation to anxiously look for reasons to think of others' achievements as less significant than they are, and are therefore likely to be able to recognise others' achievements as such. As a result, they're going to be likely to be well-guided in their own attempts to improve, since accurately recognising others' achievements enables one to have good models of how to be successful and wisely choose who to emulate. Humility also has some indirect external benefits. The humble person is typically a good listener and good at taking advice from others. They're likely to be willing to listen to others in the first place and unlikely to be dismissive of what others have to say. Therefore, they're going to be well positioned to gain knowledge that enables them to become better. Since the humble person doesn't care about relative superiority, they're less likely to be invested in pernicious stereotypes about what others have to teach us. Properly listening to someone involves thinking that the speaker might have something to tell us, that they may know some things that we do not. So it involves attributing some possible epistemic goods to another and acknowledging that we might not possess them. This acknowledgement can grate against the kind of felt need to assert our own rightness, see ourselves with as the ones of knowledge, with kind of greater epistemic authority or success. And for the person who valorises relative positioning, such an acknowledgement will be particularly painful, unless they're likely to be motivated to avoid it. But the humble person won't be threatened by the thought that others might possess epistemic goods that they do not. They're not invested in the idea that others are below them on some hierarchical scale, nor that they're unlikely to have anything they need to communicate. So a significant barrier to being a good listener and being good at taking advice is therefore missing in the humble person, enabling them to gain important knowledge. So humility lessens some important barriers to ethical growth, both by removing a distorting factor in our judgments and by removing an obstacle to receiving testimony. Secondly, humility is important for ethical growth because it enables us to have motivational or effective responses that aid ethical development. That is, it enables us to react in the right kinds of way to our own and others' achievements or failures. So recall the example of the humble runner, Anna. On recognising that someone else is a better runner than she is, she wouldn't feel envy or resentment. Rather, she'd be likely to feel admiration for their achievement. So Anna's response seems like the appropriate response to admirable achievements, but it also seems likely to help her to become a better runner, to be motivating her to emulate the person in question. By contrast, the person who valorises relative positioning might feel only envy or resentment, and might feel motivated to cool down the better runner rather than to improve themselves. And that's Uriah Heep's response. Alternatively, simply recognising others' relative superiority might lead the non-humble runner to feel discouraged from running at all, which is what happens with Gwendolyn. Her lack of relative success discourages her from appreciating or participating in music. So the humble person, then, is not only in a good position to recognise others' successes, but is also disposed to react to such successes in ways that enable them to emulate such success, and therefore to become better at the activity in question. It suggested that humility removes common barriers to ethical development then, that are both epistemic and motivational. And as a result, the humble person will be disposed to become better. This isn't any guarantee that the humble person will develop ethically, but it at least suggests that they're well placed to do so. Humility is then an interesting trait and one worth seeking for two distinct reasons. Not only because it's a virtue, but because it has this important role in enabling us to become better.
Thank you.